It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, the mayor.
Poverty.
Climate change. Unemployment. Name a problem, and Washington seems unable to solve it. Immigration. Education. Enter the mayor. Pragmatic, problem-solving, nonpartisan, mayors just might be the next best hope for democracy. That's according to political theorist Benjamin Barber. The title of his recent book puts it right on the line. If Mayors Ruled the World. Steve Paulson caught up with him at a Chicago conference on cities and sustainability.
Ben, why do you think we'd be better off if mayors ruled the world?
Well, we'd be better off if almost anybody else ruled the world and the people who are ruling it, which is the CEOs of giant carbon corporations and financial banks, which have no interest in public goods, which is the leaders of nation states stuck in ideology and embedded in their sovereignty and unable to cooperate. So you might say that almost anybody would be an alternative. I argue that mayors in particular, however, are efficient, pragmatic problem solvers, closer to their people, more democratic, and indeed, since cities today have over half of the world's population in them, in the Western world it's actually 80%, cities really are democratically representative of the world's population, and mayors are already cooperating with one another across borders and dozens of intercity organizations and global organizations. So in every way, mayors are better positioned, more capable of, and more interested in solving real human problems. It's all about real stuff. Real stuff. And if mayors don't do the real stuff, forget the rest. And it doesn't matter whether they're right or left, Republican or Democrat, Labor or Tory, mayors don't and can't afford to take sides. You can't as mayor say, I'm a union guy, don't talk to business, or I'm a business guy, don't talk to unions. You got to talk to both. You need a coalition. You need people to work with you. So mayors are problem solvers, they're pragmatists, and they're also neighbors. And what's interesting is that the trust level in politicians around the world at the national and state level is really poor. We know the Congress of the United States has dropped to an 8% trust rating. But if you ask people, do you trust your mayors, your city councilors, the trust levels are still at 70 and 75%, which is remarkable in these cynical times. So you might say urban democracy, municipal democracy, is the only place where people still really believe in democracy.
What about the big problems out there, whether it's crime or unemployment or a global problem like climate change? Is more effective action going to happen at the level of cities?
Well, again, cities are dealing with these issues for two reasons. One, because they have to, because the states aren't. And the second, because they can and they're well positioned to do so. Even an issue which most people associate with the national government, immigration, you know, the national government sets the standards for who can and who can't cross the border. But we know in the United States and Europe and all over the world, the great number of immigrants who cross borders cross illegally. They become undocumented residents of countries in which they have no right technically to be, but in which the logic of the global economy with jobs draws them. In the United States, we've got almost 12 million undocumented immigrants who are living here with families and so forth, and cities are in a position of saying, what are we going to do about them? The national government says they don't exist, and if they find them, they throw them out. And meanwhile, they live in great numbers. 10, 15% of urban populations made up of these immigrants. Mr. de Blasio of New York recently, in his State of the City, just announced he was going to make available city IDs, what some people call city visas, to every resident of New York who wants it. Doesn't matter whether they're documented, undocumented, immigrant, born New Yorker, you will get that ID. You'll be on the books. Your kids can go to school. You can get jobs. You can get medical care. The police will know who you are and what your address is so they can keep track of you and so forth.
So he's basically sidestepping the whole immigration debate in Congress.
He is. He's not just sidestepping. He's saying, look, you guys aren't doing anything. You're frozen. You know, and you know there are 12 million people here who are, quote, illegal, but they're here and you're not telling us what to do with them. Well, we'll take the decision. We'll do it. My own belief is if enough cities do that, you'll find a soft road to full citizenship status, because a desperate government looking for a way to deal with the reality of undocumented workers will say, well, if they live for 5 or 10 years with a city visa in a city and live according to the law, maybe that's a good way to give them, put them on the road to national citizenship. But whether or not that happens doesn't matter. Immigration is an issue cities can and will deal with because they have to and because they can.
So when you look around the world, I mean, you've studied cities around the world. I'm sure there are lots of cities that are doing things well, but two or three model cities that kind of jump out at you, this is how it should be done.
In Europe, Hamburg is an amazing city. It's just declared the first green capital of Europe. It does wind turbines in the city. It has zero emission buses. It has a program of compact communities in which you look for density and then put green spaces around them rather than the sort of massive spread that you have in so many American cities. So Hamburg is a place that's doing all these things, but it's doing it with a mayor who understands you can't do it at the expense of economic development. So he's working very hard to show that a sustainable economy and a prosperous economy are not incompatible, that you can do, if you find the right policies, you can do both at the same time. So Hamburg is a great example. Singapore, which is another city state, well, some people have problems with a rather authoritarian government, although that's loosening up over time, has in terms of housing policy and environmental policy been a global leader. The housing system there allows people to buy subsidized housing and then resell it and keep the profits. And it allows people, when they're young, to have a 1 or 2 room. When they have families, the 3 or 4 room. When they get old, to stay in the same building and move to a 1 or 2 room. Again, the private development industry benefits because they build the housing. The population benefits because they're the ones to whom the housing is sold, and they own it, and they make the profits when it's sold. And everybody has a sense of place. Families stay together in the same building. It's been a very, very successful policy being imitated now in other cities around the world.
Well, let me ask you about Detroit. I mean, if there is a poster child of what not to do in a city, it would seem to be Detroit, which recently went bankrupt.
And totally wrong. I mean, that's to say, that perception, obviously it did go bankrupt. That's not wrong. Why it went bankrupt is because of the way in which we define our cities. Detroit and many other cities were, in the United States, founded in the 18th and 19th century. And of course, back then, the city limits were very narrow. Detroit, inside its old city limits, is one thing. That's a city that in 1950 was the fourth largest city in the United States with 2 million people and all of the automobile industry located there. Very, very successful city. Within 40 years, it had lost two-thirds of its population. It's under 700,000 today. Half its schools, parks shut down. Terrible problem. And you say, so doesn't that show that, Detroit and other old industrial cities can't make it? But here's the reality. The reality is the 10 counties around Detroit that make up the actual Detroit today, the greater Detroit metropolitan region, served by Detroit's cultural institutions, served by its universities, served by its transportation system. Those 10 counties, while Detroit was shrinking, went from 3 to 5 million people. A lot of the industry that left downtown Detroit settled in those counties around it. And those counties today are the fourth most advanced, prosperous new tech zone in the United States. And if you count that as Detroit, Detroit's not bankrupt. It's one of the most successful areas of America with a downtown area that has some problems that you got to deal with. But right now, the downtown area is in effect hived off, left with no resources, told to take care of itself, while all the counties that it created and whose prosperity came from Detroit in the city are off on their own, enjoying their resources, enjoying their tax revenues, but not taking responsibility. So a lot of places have that problem. They are narrowly defined by old jurisdictional boundaries, which no longer comport with the reality of how America's zones are drawn and the areas where people live and this and what they serve. New York City serves, with its transportation system, with its arts and culture, and with its financial industry, serves an area of about 30 or 40 million people. But it's reliant on the 8 million inside the 5 boroughs for its revenues, for its support, and so forth. And that's crazy. I mean, it's a really screwed up thing. And we really need a fundamental redefinition a reboundarying of our cities. And to get that, you know, what you need is an urban party. You need citizens saying, wait a minute. So redrawing jurisdictional boundaries of cities is a big, big aim and objective for a smart mayors today.
Benjamin Barber is the author of If Mayors Ruled the World. Steve Paulson talked with him. Okay, that's the big picture. But how does city democracy work, really work, when you get down to the nitty-gritty ground floor level? In Chicago's 49th Ward, Cecilia Salinas works for Alderman Joe Moore as his participatory budgeting coordinator. That's a really big title. What it means is she works with the residents of the 49th Ward to help them decide how to spend their ward's money. Under participatory budgeting, or PB, the alderman has turned his discretionary funds, called his menu money, over to them.
Basically, every alderman in Chicago is in charge of what they call menu money, $1.3 million that every, like I said, every alderman in Chicago, there are 50 of them, have discretionary money and decisions with this money.
And what do they usually use it for?
Basically, the menu money is to use it in infrastructure projects, capital improvements.
So this is like making sure the streets don't have huge potholes in them.
Yes, street resurfacing, street lights, sidewalks, speed humps.
Did your office decide to just open up all that money, the $1.3 million, to participatory budgeting?
The first year, it was done that way. But right after the first year, the first PB cycle finish was done, they felt that they need to have to reserve some money aside, so to pay with the overruns or emergencies, because it's the only money that they have, that he has. It's only $1 million since 2011.
How does this process actually work, opening the budget up to the public? I mean, I'm imagining a scene like one of those town hall meetings in Parks and Rec, you know, with everybody just yelling at each other.
No, it's not that way. It doesn't work that way, no. It's a very labor-intense because you need to prepare the community each year. So we held usually a total of nine assemblies, six in English, one in Spanish, and two of them are for high school students.
And what happens at those?
And these assemblies, we present, we have a presentation about what is PB and what we have done with PB, with the PB project so far. And then we divide the room in usually it's three or four groups, depends of the attendance. And then we have facilitators that are also members from the community. And then we explore ideas, new ideas. And then we have a big, big meeting when we call all the volunteers that sign up at these assemblies to follow up with these ideas and develop the projects during the next 3 or 4 months. And then they present all these ideas that are ready for the ballot, to be ready for the votes.
So for the votes, does everybody in the whole community vote? I mean, anybody who wants to? It's not just people who've been to the assemblies or people who are on subgroups?
No. Everybody in the community, and this is, I think this is the beauty of this process. Every resident of the 49th Ward is allowed to vote, regardless their citizen status, immigration status, and if he's 16 years or older.
What kind of ideas has the neighborhood voted to fund so far? And how different are they from, say, what your staff might have funded?
When we have the menu money spent before this process, it was mainly done through lights, used through street lights, streets resurfacing, sometimes sidewalks and some alleys. But during the first year of participatory budgeting, we have like 24 projects, from doggy parks to solar garbage containers to beach showers, playground, community garden, 32 murals.
32 murals, wow.
In 2010, the community voted for 30 murals. And then in 2012, the community felt that there were some viaducts that need to be decorated. So they vote for more.
So you got a lot more colorful districts than you used to have.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it's beautiful to see it. And also, we want to be we want to attract other people in the city and make them possible. You know, we have these murals, and so it's really colorful and vibrant. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's really interesting.
So it sounds like participatory budgeting has made the kinds of things and the kinds of projects you take on more imaginative, more creative.
Yes. Yes, they are more creative. We're trying to look for this. So through the years, they have been very creative. And I think this is it's like a refreshment to the community to see. It's not a cookie cutter process. So you don't know what is going to happen, what kind of projects are going to come up in the next cycle. You'll never know.
Do you think this process has changed how people in the neighborhood feel about their government?
I think so. It has changed and has educated the people in the community because they are more aware of how things are being made, how the process is. And also not only the community, the city. Because the city has also has to change on the way that they do the process to make things happen.
What do you
in
mean?
The community. You know, sometimes we tend to say that the city in different places, its city governments are more bureaucratic and things take more time than others. So with this process, we have been making them thinking that they have to find more creative ways to do things quicker.
Another plus I can imagine, I'm just trying to think about what it would feel like if my neighborhood was run this way. And I'm imagining people would start gradually to have a greater sense of ownership of their neighborhood. You know, if you've helped make the decision that, you know, that sidewalk's going to be replaced or that bike path is going to be put in, you might, I don't know, feel like you want to do a little more to maintain it.
Yes, we have found that too. And this is it's a beautiful thing because the people have a more sense of community. They feel more incorporated and they feel like they have been heard. And this is very important. They also participate more in different ways.
Like what?
Oh, if they weren't in PPE, working with us, volunteering for PPE, they also decided to also get involved with parks. They have been, they became members of park advisory councils.
So they get pulled into other parts of civic life.
Yes.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
That's fascinating. Thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thank you for having me.
Cecilia Salinas is the Participatory Budgeting Coordinator for Joe Moore, the alderman for Chicago's 49th Ward, the Rogers Park neighborhood. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. There's only one mayor I know personally, and that's my neighbor, Mayor Dave. He's actually the former mayor of Madison, Wisconsin, and his real name is Dave Cheslevich, but everyone still calls him Mayor Dave. One of his big heroes is the late urban thinker Jane Jacobs. She lived in Toronto, and when Dave told us he was headed there for a conference and was planning on visiting her old neighborhood, we gave him a tape recorder.
I was a street musician on the corner of Barthurst and Bloor Street in Jane Jacobs' neighborhood. So Jane Jacobs lives in a pretty funky neighborhood. I'm standing here on the corner of Bloor and Barthurst Streets, and I'm looking at the Green Beanery coffee shop, no doubt shade growing. Next to it, the Insomnia Martini Lounge. Looks very very new age, very upscale. Next to that, Alibaba's Middle Eastern Cuisine. Does not look so upscale. And next to that, Dragonfly Belly Dance. So I would say we're here at the frontier between a little rundown and the invading hordes of yuppies. So now we're walking down Albany Street. This is Jane Jacobs Street, the street where she lives. Corner of Albany and Bloor. There's a Starbucks. I'm not sure how Jane Jacobs would feel about Starbucks.
Dave, why Jane Jacobs? What made you want to go in search of her?
Well, if you're a mayor, Jane Jacobs sort of wrote the Bible. She wrote a book in 1962 called The Death and Life of Great American Cities. And it really set the world on fire. She challenged every prevailing view about what good planning was, what good transportation policy was. She basically said, look, cities have neighborhoods. Neighborhoods are really complex, sometimes messy places. And we should appreciate cities for really what they are. And she really asked herself, well, how does a city actually function day to day? What makes a city an interesting place? Jane Jacobs really set the tone for the way we think about cities today.
You asked a question a minute ago. You asked if Jane Jacobs would have approved of the Starbucks in her neighborhood. What do you think? And what do you think of Starbucks?
Well, it's a philosophical question that we can all wrestle with. I think she probably would have been okay with it, because what she was about really was about mixing it up on the street, giving people an opportunity for all of those unplanned interactions that people have that actually turn out to be the basis for today's creative economy. You know, engineers meeting artists and architects talking to lawyers and doctors talking to dancers and all of those weird connections that you get in a city. That's what makes a city an interesting place, is that you have these concentrations of people from all different kinds of backgrounds, and they get together and they mix it up, and they come up with all kinds of art and products and commerce, and they create families with interesting children and all this stuff, simply because they ran into each other in a city. And the thing about a Starbucks is, and maybe I might like a locally owned coffee shop more, but the thing about a Starbucks is it's a place like that. It's what we sometimes call a third place, where people come and mix it up. So I think Jane Jacobs would be okay with a Starbucks.
Okay. Well, let's hear a bit more of the tape from your Toronto tour.
Name, please.
Alicia Liang.
What do you do?
I am a transportation planner.
Does Toronto have soul?
I believe Toronto has soul, yes.
How do you define soul?
A place with vibrancy, a place where people gather on the streets, where everyone feels comfortable on the streets.
And Toronto has that?
I think Toronto does.
Okay, such a great question. When does a city have soul?
Well, if you could answer that question, I think it's the sort of question you really can't answer flat out. I think you just feel it. It's really very intuitive. I mean, think about how you feel when you go into a big suburban shopping mall, right? You walk in, it's a comfortable place, right? I mean, the temperature is controlled and there are the stores you want. You go and buy stuff. But do you really feel like you're in a particular place? Do you really feel like, hey, I could be in a shopping mall in Cleveland or Los Angeles or Milwaukee. It doesn't matter. And then how do you feel when you're in a place like here in Madison? It would be State Street. In New York, it would be maybe Greenwich Village. How do you feel when you're there? Do you get a sense of place? Do you get a sense that this is unique and different from every other place that I've been? People know when they're in a place that works, and they know when they're in a place that doesn't.
And so what's the role of the mayor in making a city vibrant?
I think a mayor simply needs to understand his or her city, sort of get the vibe of the place and how it works and how it functions. I still tell aspiring politicians, there's no better job, no better public job than mayor. I would have rather been mayor than governor or president any day of the week.
because you can get stuff done. Mayors deal in tangible things, and their constituents want them to be there, and you get immediate feedback. If you're doing something right, people shout out in the street, thanks, very nice job. If you're not doing something right, you hear other things. And so it's immediate, it's tangible, you're very close. And what I tell aspiring politicians is, I would want to be mayor if I were you, but keep this in mind, it is the most personal and intimate of public roles. When people are voting for congressperson or senator, it's sort of abstract. But when they're voting for mayor, they're looking at you and they're asking themselves, can I see that person representing me? Can I see that person speaking for me? Can I see that person sort of reflecting what my city is about? It's deeply personal. And so you make this connection with people and with the city that really you don't get a chance to make in any other political job anyplace else.
Wow. You just made me want to be a mayor.
You should be a mayor. Everybody should be a mayor.
Dave Cheslevich was the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin from 2003 to 2011. Mayor Dave, as he's still known, is currently the executive director of the Wisconsin Bike Federation. That's the recognizable voice of the Icelandic pop star Björk. For a lot of people around the world, Björk is Iceland. But the country has a new celebrity these days, the mayor of Reykjavik. His name is John Gnarr. He's a professional comedian. He ran for mayor as a lark and, to his surprise, won. He just completed a 4-year term and published a memoir, and Charles Monroe Kane talked with him about his unorthodox style as mayor and the absurd campaign that got him elected.
I don't know what the phrase equivalent in Iceland is for smartass, but it was such a smartass campaign. I couldn't believe some of the stuff you tried to do. I was reading some of the stuff you talked about. I mean, one of my favorites was you wanted to make a replica of the Statue of Liberty in the form of Bjork holding a microphone instead of a torch. You promised everyone a free towel and that there would be a polar bear in the zoo. You even promised to break every one of your promises. There's no way you expected to win, did you?
Well, no, not at the beginning. I just saw it as fun, but then realized that that's exactly what people were so thirsty for.
Right.
So, in a way, my joke was on me, really. And I just tried to be as absurd as possible in the campaign and you know, come up with the most ridiculous promises and slogans.
What do you think is the most ridiculous one you came up with, the one you're most proud of?
I guess the Björk statue was the most surrealistic idea promise.
It's too bad it didn't happen.
Yeah, because I think it would make a great statue. I mean, with artificial intelligence, so it could, like, look down at people and talk directly to people and, like, with laser beams from her eyes and, like, quote Björk songs and also information about Iceland and Reykjavik. And,
I noticed online when I searched for you, not only does Björk come up, but she talks about you. It's a small country. What did she think of your campaign? Did she do anything for it? I know you made a rock video. She wasn't in it. Well, mm-hmm. How did she feel about it? And would she have stood for hours to get sculpted around, you know, to make a statue?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so, right?
No, but she's been very... she's been happy with the best party. I mean, it is the best possible party, so...
And the best party, of course, is the political party that you created around you. The best party. What was your slogan? You had a great slogan.
Yeah, it's just simply the best.
It's a great slogan. We're the best. We're not going to keep any of our campaign promises, and we're the best.
Anything else is rubbish. Vote for the best.
Now, there must have been a moment in your life. I want you to take us back to May 28th, 2010. This is the eve of your election. You're the 21st mayor of Reykjavik, by far the most powerful, most important city in your country. Mm-hmm. You must have been like, holy crap. Now what am I going to do? Because you can't just keep a joke going that long. It can't be absurd. You've got to run a city. You've got to help people out. There's problems. Iceland had major economic collapse. What was going through your head?
Well, it's probably similar to when I had my first kid. A time of great fun, and but suddenly there's a kid, there's a child, and you have to take care of it, and it brings with it a lot of responsibility. And I, of course, asked myself, what have I gotten myself into now? And I couldn't get it all in at once. It took me a while to realize what the nature of my job was. But I decided to tackle it like any other job that I've done in my life.
The more conservative people in your country, and certainly the people who lost power because of you and as a very powerful position you had, they must have been waiting for you to see what you're going to do. And you did one of the most absurd things I've ever heard of in my life in politics. Immediately after getting elected, you made an announcement that you would not enter a coalition government with anyone who had not watched the entire HBO series The Wire. Are you serious?
No.
You must have blown their minds, man.
Oh, I'm so proud of that. I just liked the idea, you know, how they would react to this. I mean, would they actually go and buy the series and watch it? No, I was just teasing them, you know, to see what they would do.
So meanwhile, you're messing with them, right? You're doing some absurd stuff.
Uh-huh.
First thing you decide to tackle as mayor is the budget. You came in, you raised taxes, you restructured with your own idea the education system of the entire city.
Mm-hmm.
You laid off the electricity utility workers that you thought were redundant.
Uh-huh.
And then you did another thing after doing all that. You balanced the budget for the first time in Reykjavik's history. You balanced the budget and then ended up having extra money to do other projects. Man, you are an absurdist comedian and a punk rocker, and you balanced the budget in the first year in office. How the hell did you do that?
Somehow it relies and depends on humbleness and serenity, I suppose. In my experience, it brings out the best in people who are working with you. And once people realize that you respect them and trust them, and in my experience, it's the same element of creating a good band compared to a bad band. It has a lot to do with the chemistry between people to spot what different people have to offer to the table.
You were serious and you did balance the budget, but at your budget meetings, you would show up wearing a Jedi outfit to fight the guys who were against your side of the budget. You gave speeches in lipstick. You came to work in drag. If you thought a meeting was boring, you would put on a gorilla mask and just leave.
Yeah. When I feel like, you know, dressing up in drag, I do. I dress up in drag because that's how I feel, what I want to do. And with a lipstick, it was when I had been in office for 6 months, my mother died. And it was in the middle of the budget making, and I didn't even have time to go through it to mourn my mother or anything. And the one thing I really loved about my mom was her ashtray and her smoking and her lipstick. And that's how I remember her putting on lipstick and smoking. So I just wanted, you know, from the estate, I just wanted the ashtray and her lipstick. And so I took up smoking and I put on her lipstick, you know, as a respect to the memory of my mother. And with the costumes, it's also about, you know, surprise. And the best party is a surprise party. It's like when you come home and all your friends are there and there's all call, yeah, surprise, surprise. But it's just for that moment, you know. They cannot leave the room again and come back and say, surprise, it's not a surprise anymore. It's just a moment. And people really appreciate surprises. And you know, when they're hopeless and gloomy, it's always nice to have a surprise. And what's more surprise than the mayor with a gorilla mask?
You're right. I can't think of anything more. Right. Good point.
So it made people smile. And when people smile, they get maybe some of the hope they had lost. And so it's just fun. And why not? Why shouldn't we all wear gorilla masks at budget meetings? I mean, especially when you're cutting down the budget.
And in the end, of course, the big question, what about the free towels at the pool and the polar bear in the zoo? Did you deliver?
No.
Oh, man. It's oh so quiet. Shh, shh. It's oh so still.
So peaceful until you fall in. Mayor John Gnarr's memoir is called How I Became the Mayor of a Large City in Iceland and Changed the World. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him. And that's it for our conversation about mayors. But we'll be back with the sound of another city, Seattle. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time to get into some deep tracks.
This is Charles R. Cross in Seattle, Washington. I'm the author of 9 books on music, including Heavier Than Heaven, the biography of Kurt Cobain, Here We Are Now, Kurt Cobain's Impact, and Roomful of Mirror, the biography of Jimi Hendrix. And here's my unappreciated album. The Fabulous Sounds of the Pacific Northwest is the debut album from Seattle's young, fresh fellows. And that band was kind of spearheaded by a guy named Scott McCoy. And I met Scott in the early 80s when he moved to Seattle to work at the Rocket, where I was working as well. He ended up writing for us, and he asked me, and I ended up art directing that album cover. We put it together with basically a promotional vinyl album from, I think, Bell Telephone had put it out, called The Fabulous Sounds of the Pacific Northwest. And basically, it's the sounds of the fairy air horn and seagulls and other things. Those little snippets on the album are interspersed with these songs that Scott and Chuck Carroll and Tad Hutchinson had kind of put together in that band. It's a great record of raw, kind of alternative rock, but this was before alternative rock kind of came around. You know, the song on Fabulous Sounds that I like the best is Rock and Roll Pest Control, which is kind of almost a Ramones-ish kind of upbeat number. Creatures are taking over my house. They want my food, my skin, and my time. Little frogs are okay, but the slugs on the rug. The town mall sent me out of my mind. There's no place else that I can go. The only thing I can turn to, Rock and Roll Pest Control. The fellows were very influential among Seattle bands at the time, sold very, very few records, but like many Seattle bands from the early 80s, they were always far more popular in Europe than they were anywhere else in America.
Hey, what's your hurry? I see. You've listened to the sounds of the Pacific Northwest, and now you just can't wait to go look. Fine, but we had one more important sound we wanted you to hear.
Well, they were walking down the street. I'd never seen a couple young, fresh fellows before. Well, there was something about the way they combed their hair and something about the clothes that they wore.
Well, they don't act so cool, they're just regular Joes. Well, they're the young fresh fellas now, nobody knows. Well, I never seen a couple young fresh fellas before.
That's Charles R. Cross on the Young Fresh Fellows album, The Fabulous Sounds of the Pacific Northwest. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, with immigration in the news, we're bringing you a conversation with the Dominican-born writer Juno Diaz, the MacArthur Genius Pulitzer Prize-winning author of some of the most brilliant contemporary fiction about the immigrant experience. He wrote the landmark novel The Brief, Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, and here's a bit of his latest short story collection. This is how you lose her.
Some nights you have new romance or dreams where you see the ex and the boy and another figure, familiar, waving at you in the distance. Somewhere very close, the laugh that wasn't laughter. And finally, when you feel like you can do so without blowing into burning atoms, you open a folder you have kept hidden under your bed, the Doomsday Book. Copies of all the emails and photos from the cheating days. The ones the ex found and compiled and mailed to you a month after she ended it. Dear Junior, for your next book. Probably the last time she wrote your name. You read the whole thing cover to cover. Yes, she put covers on it. You are surprised at what a coward you are. It kills you to admit it, but it is true. You are astounded by the depths of your mendacity. When you finish the book a second time, you say the truth. You did the right thing, Negra. You did the right thing. She's right. This would make a killer book, Elvis says. The two of you have been pulled over by a cop and are waiting for the officer to finish running your license. Elvis holds up one of the photos. She's Colombian, you say. He whistles. Que viva Colombia. Hand you back the book. You really should write The Cheater's Guide to Love. You think? I do. It takes a while. You see the tall girl. You go to more doctors. You celebrate Arlenny's PhD defense. And then one June night, you scribble the ex's name, and the half-life of love is forever. You bust out a couple more things, and then you put your head down. The next day, you look at the new pages. For once, you don't want to burn them or give up writing forever. It's a start, you say to the room. That's about it. In the months that follow, you bend to the work because it feels like hope, like grace, and because you know in your lying cheater's heart that sometimes a start is all we ever get.
That's Juno Diaz reading from his short story collection, This Is How You Lose Her. Steve Paulson recently caught up with him to talk about the book and its main character.
The narrator in all these stories is a guy named Junior, who's now appeared in three of your books. And he has an interesting combination of, he's kind of a geekish book lover, and also someone with a lot of street smarts. How would you describe Junior?
Yeah, I think like many of the men I grew up with, Junior is sort of, you know, deeply disguised. Which is to say, I think many of the men I grew up with, and again, that doesn't mean every guy in the world, but just a small group of dudes, spent a lot of time passing for men. So Junior is actually this young Dominican immigrant who grew up most of his life in the U.S., Central Jersey, from a tough family in a tough neighborhood, very tough-minded and practical, super hardworking, but as you point out, highly intellectual, highly literate, obsessed with history, with books, with literature, and spends all his time trying to pass for a kind of traditional masculine, not sensitive, not intellectual dude.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like you were also creating your own kind of immigrant narrative. I mean, Junior, as you said, he grows up a poor Dominican kid, and there's a lot of pressure on him to stay true to his roots, not to get out, not to assimilate into white culture. But he also gravitates to the world of literature and high culture. And so the question is, can he continue to live in both those worlds, or does he have to choose?
Well, but I mean, I would argue that there's just as much pressure for Junior to assimilate as there is pressure for anything. I think the last part of your proposition was kind of true, is that everybody wants young people to pick a side. This is not a society that encourages people to have very complex, simultaneous identities, not to have contradictory identities. We don't kind of like that. We don't sort of encourage it. We don't kind of model that for young people. And so, you know, you have Junior's friends and families and neighbors and folks around him saying crazy negative things about the community, and including Junior, saying crazy negative things about the community that makes him possible. And I think what matters most about a character like this, and at least for me in my mind in this context, is that this is a character who is trying to find a way to live simultaneously, to duck that sort of false choice of you have to choose one. I think anytime someone tries to limit you at the buffet to one thing, this is not a friend. This is kind of a hostile sort of proposition. And I think Junior makes an argument for that even as an immigrant, that's only making explicit who we all are, which is all of us are living in multiple worlds. And all of us are encouraged to reduce those worlds, to be reductive, to simplify, to our detriment. It's not good for us to fit ourselves into a simplistic box, to chop limbs off of our character, of our history, of who we are, in order to fit in a very tidy little box. This is a violence which I don't think is beneficial to anyone.
Well, did you feel that pressure yourself, especially as you were growing up, that you had to choose between one of these two narratives?
Oh, my God. Yeah. I mean, again, I think this is not simply a matter for, you know, someone from my background. I think that this is a matter for everybody. People are always being asked to, where's your loyalty to family? Where's your loyalty to friends? Where's your loyalty to home? Where's your loyalty to your ambition? What happens when you go to college? Oh, you left for school. You think you're so smart. Oh, you know, you stayed at home. You don't know what the real world is like. I think that there's always this kind of reductive impulse. It's, I think people feel very uncomfortable at times, not all people, but some people feel very uncomfortable at times with the idea that everyone inside themselves contains those sort of multitudes that the great poet spoke of. And I guess in my mind, I saw my friends who were born in the U.S. having the same exact kind of pressure, them being asked to sort of lop parts of themselves off to fit in. And I think that this is, you know, this is something that as an artist you feel attracted to. I think it's a metaphor that many immigrants undergo. I think it's something that really connects all of us together in a way.
Well, we're often told that America is the immigrant country, and there are these traditional stories. I mean, the common story is either you do assimilate or you sort of stay true to your roots. And I guess, I mean, obviously you're saying that, you know, that binary is a problem. I mean, that doesn't reflect reality, and which raises the question of whether there's a new kind of immigrant literature that needs to be written. Maybe it's being written now, but are there lots of stories that need to be told that really have not been told yet?
Well, no question. I mean, no question. Look, I mean, I don't know if you saw those Vita statistics and the follow-up statistics about the way that books are getting reviewed, what kind of books are getting reviewed. Even though our country is fantastically diverse, even though in our country can be found the histories and the communities of almost the entire world, it's still a country that represents itself in its literature and in its popular culture as overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly male. We know this. It's something that we have to work against because, you know, having a delusional sense of ourselves is never a good idea when clearly the future is going to demand of us a lot of hard decisions and a lot of hard collective action. And so I think that without any doubt, the majority of the stories that we need to tell to bear witness to ourselves as a country haven't been told yet.
So there's a whole new literature yet to be written. I mean, because, you know, a lot of people say, oh, you know, it's like literature has played out. It's exhausted. You're saying, no way.
I deny that proposition. I deny that claim even without taking into consideration anything that's happened in the future. But the question I always ask the person who makes that claim is, how many books did you read last year? So wait, basically you're basing this, not you, but that person is basing this outrageous, this kind of outrageous, just, I don't know how to describe it, you know, this outrageous kind of argument on almost nothing. less than 1% of 1% of the reading available in this language. And I do think that these kind of sweeping cultural generalizations, these Jeremiads, these sort of like doomish pronouncements reveal more about the symbolic place, the sort of cultural capital that we invest in the arts, and just reveal more of the way that the arts have been underappreciated, the way the arts are in many ways under attack by people who are not even, I would argue, they don't even have an authoritative sense of the field they're talking about. I mean, how does someone who hasn't read 2,000 novels last year, how can they speak to me about the role of the novel? And I think that this is what ends up happening. When we talk about arts, often a lot of nonsense gets passed for authoritative information.
I think you need to be out there writing more essays about this kind of thing, too.
Oh, God.
In fact, Juno Diaz did write that essay, and it was recently published in The New Yorker. You can read it on our website at ttbook.org. Diaz talked with Steve Paulson about his short story collection, This Is How You Lose Her. Before we go, here's one last bit from it.
Since we weren't allowed out of the house, it's too cold, Poppy said once, but really there was no reason other than that's what he wanted. We mostly sat in front of the TV or stared out at the snow those first days. Mommy cleaned everything about 10 times and made us some damn elaborate lunches. We were all bored speechless. Pretty early on, Mommy decided that watching TV was beneficial. You could learn the language from it. She saw our young minds as bright, spiky sunflowers in need of light and arranged us as close to the TV as possible to maximize our exposure. We watched the news, sitcoms, cartoons, Tarzan, Flash Gordon, Johnny Quest, The Herculoids, Sesame Street. 8-9 hours of TV a day, but it was Sesame Street that gave us our best lessons. Each word my brother and I learned, we passed between ourselves, repeating over and over. And when Mommy asked us to show her how to say it, we shook our heads and said, don't worry about it. Just tell me, she said. And when we pronounced the word slowly, forming huge, lazy soap bubbles of sounds, she never could duplicate them. Her lips seemed to tug apart even the simplest vowels. That sounds horrible, I said. What do you know about English, she asked. At dinner, she'd try her English out on Papi, but he just poked at his pernil, which was not my mother's best dish. I can't understand a word you're saying, he said finally. It's best if I take care of the English. How do you expect me to learn? You don't have to learn, he said. Besides, the average woman can't learn English. It's a difficult language to master, he said, first in Spanish and then in English. Mommy didn't say another word. In the morning, as soon as Papi was out of the apartment, Mommy turned on the TV and put us in front of it.
Se siente bien, contigo baby yo me siento bien, yeah. Si tú te sientes bien, olvídate del mundo tú también, yeah. No te vayas en sentimiento.
And that's it for today's show. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show with help from Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, Raymond Tangakar, and Will Hinkes. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for joining us.
PRI, Public Radio International.